Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Well, we did it. We defeated Issue 1, the Republican bill to restrict access to the process for amending the state's constitution. The issue was placed on the ballot by the legislature and slated for a special election on August 8th, in spite of the legislature having recently adopted a rule against August special elections due to the cost and ineffectiveness. Republicans had hoped for lower voter turnout and to mobilize their low-information evangelical base to sneak this one by, but the opposition was organized and alert, led first by women's rights advocates and joined by unions, the ACLU, former governors, and even a portion of Republican voters. Voter turnout was really impressive, and the no votes won a resounding victory. That means that two bills that were slated to be on the November ballot can proceed. One would amend the state's constitution to protect the right to an abortion, and another would legalize marijuana. We'll hear a press conference by Ohioans for Reproductive Rights, a coalition of groups which together gathered enough signatures to place the issue before the Ohio voters in November. Polls have shown this one is likely to pass. Then we'll hear an interview with David Wallace Wells speaking about climate change and the recent fires in the U.S. and Canada. First, here's the press conference.
Very much for joining us as Ohioans United for Reproductive Rights celebrates a terrific victory in the August special election. We look forward to protecting reproductive freedom in November. So if our friends in the media can please keep your cameras off and keep your mute function on, we'll have an introduction from Dr. Bean and then Dr. Thakliapati will answer your questions. Dr. Sri Thakliapati is the interim executive director for Preterm, one of Ohio's 9 abortion clinics serving patients today. Dr. Thakliapati has been a part of the Preterm family for more than 20 years. Dr. Lauren Bean is a general pediatrician practicing in the Cleveland area. She's a co-founder and executive director for Ohio Physicians for Reproductive Rights. We're very proud to have both of them here representing the Ohioans United for Reproductive Rights Coalition. So, Dr. Bean, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I hope you all got some sleep last night. I have to admit, I'm really running on quite a bit of adrenaline today myself. So as Gabe mentioned, my name is Dr. Lauren Bean. I'm a general pediatrician here in Ohio, and I'm a co-founder of the Ohio Physicians for Reproductive Rights, and I'm a partner of Ohioans United for Reproductive Rights. On a typical weekday morning, I'd be seeing young patients in my office, but instead I'm here today to fight for those same patients and their families, as well as for Ohioans. Yesterday was a great day for democracy. Ohioans rejected an outrageous attempt by extremists to silence our voices and insert government into our families' most personal medical decisions. Today, we begin the battle to protect our constitutional rights and reject government interference in November. But really, this fight began over a year ago when Roe v. Wade was overturned.
Hey, can you start these Ben Centrals for me?
The first Monday after the Dobbs decision was a very emotional day for me. That morning, I had to field calls from the mother of a 13-year-old patient of mine who was worried that her child might need birth control in case she were the victim of sexual assault. I talked to terrified parents as well as confused and distraught teenagers, and it was terrible. That day I came home from work and I learned from the news that there were similar terrible stories of women's lives being put at risk because of inaccess to common medical care, including miscarriage care that was delayed or denied. And I knew that I had to do something. I had to protect the health, autonomy, and freedom of all Ohioans, including my patients. And so this year, along with hundreds of organizations, thousands of Ohioans, 4,000 doctors, and over 700,000 Ohio voters, we successfully put a reproductive freedom amendment on the November ballot. Ohioans deserve to make their voices heard on this critical issue. We deserve the right to make our own private medical decisions about pregnancy and abortion, along with our family, without the government meddling in our business. This November, we will have the opportunity to vote yes to protect our reproductive rights. We will vote yes to ensure our families have the freedom to make decisions that are best for us. All year, hundreds of thousands of Ohioans have been standing up for our reproductive freedom. They've asked tough questions. They're demanding answers from politicians. They're volunteering, talking to our neighbors, and signing our ballot petition to protect abortion rights. The stakes couldn't be higher. If we don't succeed, the government will have the power to ban abortion completely, even in cases of rape, incest, or when someone's life is in danger. We've seen the devastating consequences of these bans and of the government interfering in private medical decisions and medical care. Together, we will not stop fighting until this battle for freedom and personal liberty is won at the ballot box in November. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bean. Now we're going to have some Q&A time with Dr. Sri Thakliapati and Dr. Bean. If members of the media could please use the hand-raising function, I'm going to do a little MC work here and call on folks to guide us through these questions. We'll have about 10 minutes. We appreciate you all hopping on. Andrew Tobias for the Plain Dealer.
Yeah, I was hoping to ask about the Ohio Supreme Court case that's, seeking to, I guess, prevent the election from happening. I'm wondering how you view that, how realistic you think it is, that kind of thing.
Dr. Thakliapati, go ahead.
Thanks for asking that question, Andrew. You know, we knew that this was forthcoming, that anti-abortion extremists in the state were really going to throw everything they could at us. We won. This shows that, we have the momentum, we have the will of the people to pass this amendment in November. And we know that we're going to have to fight this battle on a number of fronts. And we're confident that we're going to win.
Yeah, so how much of a threat do you think that case really is?
You know, I think we have to see how it plays out in the courts, but we were prepared for this kind of challenge.
And I'll add to that in the statements that our team made, I thought it was very eloquently put that that case against us is pretty absurd. And it expects us to have done something that is actually impossible and has no legal precedent. So we don't actually see it as a significant threat. It's more of a distraction, waste of time and money. And that's about it.
Christian Hauser, WKRC.
Kind of continuing with this line, I guess, obviously there's going to be a lot of challenges that you expect to come up. I guess, what's the plan in dealing with it? It seems that voters do at least want some abortion access. I guess, how do you all keep the momentum going as you approach November?
I'm happy to take this one. The anti-choice side has been throwing whatever they can think of at us to try to distract and confuse, slow down, really anything that they can. And so far, all of their attempts have been unsuccessful and in some cases actually caused that momentum to get even stronger. And so, I think that, the momentum is here. It is moving. We are moving. We will win in November. And we know there will be many efforts along the way to try to slow us down. But we've been dealing with that for the past year. And we won't let anything get in our way of protecting our patients' access to abortion and anything related to reproductive health care.
And if I could add to that, they've actually been throwing it at us for 49 years. right? We've been fighting this fight for 49 years. And I think what we've shown, we've had access in Ohio for that time, is that people really support this as a basic human right. Ohioans have a sense of fair play. They have a sense of what should be private decisions. And they don't want government interference in these decisions. And we know that again and again. We've seen it again and again. We've been fighting for almost 50 years and been prevailing. So we have, you know, the short-term momentum from this last year when we lost the federal protections for abortion. But Ohioans have been showing up for this issue for decades.
Alice Ulstein?
Thanks so much for holding the call. I wanted to ask what you think are some of the sort of unique factors in Ohio compared to the states that voted on abortion rights referendums last year, and how that's shaping your efforts and messaging.
Dr. Thakliupati, go ahead.
Yeah, I can take that. You know, that's a interesting question. I think actually we're very similar to other states. I think Americans have shown again and again that this is a not a partisan issue, that there's wide support for abortion rights. I don't think Ohio is unique in the way that we think about a basic human right, and which is access to abortion, the ability to control our own bodies and reproductive decisions without the interference of the government. And, you know, I think what we really see, like we did in last year after the Dobbs decision, is people understand what's at stake. And if I could just take a minute to talk about that, you know, after the Dobbs decision, we operated under the so-called heartbeat ban, which effectively banned abortion at 6 weeks. And it was devastating for the people of Ohio. You know, we talked to hundreds of patients on the phone. We turned away hundreds of patients in those 2 months. And they were terrified about whether or not they were going to be able to get out of state to get an abortion. So I don't think that we're unique. I think actually Ohio is very much like Kansas, like Michigan, which had broad support across party lines for the right to abortion.
Tessa Stewart, Rolling Stone.
Hey there. Thanks for holding the call. I was wondering, just with yesterday's victory fresh in your mind, as you're looking towards November, from an organizing perspective, what lessons you're taking from the special election as you get ready for this next fight in November?
Organizing lessons. So I would say that our takeaway has been, wow, Ohio is great at organizing. You know, we are really a state that has a tremendous amount of grassroots energy and power. And we, as was the case with the Vote No and On Issue One campaign, the special election that just happened, they had this huge, powerful, diverse coalition that included organizations, big and small, representing people from all over the state, from all political backgrounds with different interests, but who all shared the common opinion that the government shouldn't be interfering in people's autonomy, whether it's in that case the right to have a citizen initiated constitutional amendment, and then as we're moving forward toward November, in the right to make our own personal medical decisions, including relating to reproductive health care, as we're focused on here. And so, you know, moving forward, I think that our biggest lesson is the power of coalitions and the power of grassroots energy and the power of the people and our voices, and how that is what is really inspiring and is what's going to make lasting change in Ohio.
Andrew?
Yeah, I was wondering, we saw the national, it looked like national kind of anti-abortion money come in and try to bail out the Yes campaign, and they failed. And I'm wondering if you think that's a significant tactical victory, and if you think also maybe that seeing the results that that might chill fundraising for the other side, given what happened this week.
That's a great question, Andrew. I think that, you know, we saw all of that national anti-choice money come in to fund the Issue One campaign that was just defeated, because Issue One was all about trying to stop what we're doing now as we are now moving toward November. And if they would have been successful, that would have made things a lot harder. But thankfully, the people of Ohio came out and raised their voices and said, no, we as Ohioans want to have the right to make our own decisions without government interference. And so, you know, what impact that will have on fundraising on our opposition side moving forward, I think time will tell. It, you know, knowing that those, that special election was there put on in August 100% because of the abortion rights amendment that we are putting forward, it really wasn't that surprising that all of that money came in to support Issue One. And thankfully, it didn't work.
Any last questions from the media? Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Thakliupati. Thank you, Dr. Bean. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please stay tuned as we continue this campaign. Look forward to talking more with everybody between now and November 7th. Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Once the ballot language has been approved and the issue numbers assigned to both reproductive rights and the cannabis bills, we'll try to get interviews with the folks campaigning for them. Our air here in Ohio has returned to normal for now, thanks to recent rains, and it has been hazy and brown due to the massive forest fires burning in Canada. Those fires are still going on, and a huge fire in California is now sweeping across the Mojave Desert, destroying millions of endangered Joshua trees. Another fire is ravaging the Hawaiian island of Maui, destroying homes and entire towns and many historic trees there as well. The fires are fueled in part by higher-than-average winds and higher-than-average temperatures caused by anthropogenic climate change. Environmental advocate David Wallace Wells spoke recently on the matter.
Well, David Wallace Wells, welcome back to the Climate Pod.
Really good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, when we first spoke with you in 2021, you talked about how distressing it was that the impacts of global warming were already worse than many had predicted. More people had suffered than expected, and adaptation measures were woefully inadequate. 2023 hasn't been any better, maybe even worse in terms of climate worsened extreme weather. What have you made of what's happened thus far in 2023?
Well, I think there are basically two really big stories going on at once, and it's a little bit hard to follow them at the same time since they seem to be running in opposite directions. And this is probably similar to the way the world looked to us in 2021, but it's gotten only more intense over time, which is to say, we have a green transition. It's actually underway. It's moving a lot faster than almost anyone believed was possible just a few years ago. There is, in that sense, quite a lot of hope. And, you know, our expectations for warming this century have come down quite a bit since 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago. We're now expecting probably something on the order of 2 to 3 degrees Celsius as opposed to 4 or 5 degrees Celsius. And that really is a major step forward. At the same time, we keep being surprised by the intensity of impacts that we're seeing, even at the temperature levels that we have to the global average temperature levels that we have today, 1.2, 1.3 degrees. And most scientists surveying the literature say that that's true, not just of what we're observing in the real world, but the way that the modeling is evolving as well, that almost every impact you look at, you know, impacts that you might have once predicted to be at arriving only at 4 degrees are now expected at 2.5 degrees, or impacts that were only expected at 5 degrees now seem possible at 3 degrees. And that means that while we have really built up a huge amount of momentum and given ourselves at the level of global average temperature quite a lot of reason for hope and optimism. The climate system itself is responding much more quickly than we feared. And as a result, we may end up even at a much lower average temperature level in something like the same ravaged place as we expected when we were projecting a future for 4 or 5 degrees. And what's distressing about this is not just that it undermines the progress that we've made to this point, it's how much uncertainty it reminds us we are living through. We look at these models, we look at the IPCC reports, we look at papers in Nature and Science, we hear interviews with incredibly pedigreed scientists who spent their entire lives studying this impact or that impact. And we want to believe that they at least, at the very least, have a good sense of where the future is heading and can tell us with some degree that allows us to plan, you know, precisely how much drought to expect, precisely how much of an impact on food production to expect, precisely what kind of heat extremes to expect. And even if those seem really grim, at least if we know, we can adapt and respond. But the climate experience of the last couple of years, I think, shows us that we know a lot less about those things than we want to believe. And that's really quite scary. Living through uncertainty is, in a lot of ways, worse than living through known apocalypse. And that's sort of where we are. There are some reasons for optimism, some reasons for hope, but we're also stepping out into uncharted territory. And we're constantly being surprised, mostly by how bad things are getting so quickly, but also just by surprises. And unfortunately, I think that's going to be the basic dynamic at play for the foreseeable future. Things are going to keep getting warmer for a while, at least probably for many decades. And the impacts of that are going to be not just bad, they're also going to be surprising. And I don't think we yet have a way of responding to that uncertainty in our politics or our culture, which means it can feel a bit disorienting, even to people like you and me who follow the science quite closely.
Yeah, I think one of those surprises, or maybe something that just caught meteorologists off guard this year, was the impact of the smoke from the Canadian wildfires here in America, right, in the Northeast. You noted in a recent column that fire historian Stephen Pine calls the era that we're living in now the Pyrocene. What surprised you the most about this year's wildfires in Canada?
Well, I would pull back even a little bit further just to orient us in our cultural understanding of wildfire more generally, which is to say Americans, even 5 years ago, even in fire-prone places like California, were really primarily worried about the destruction of their homes and communities, human loss of life, but also houses being burned, and in the case of, you know, a town like Paradise, whole towns being destroyed. This is really the paramount preeminent anxiety as related to fire that anyone in America had. And if you lived somewhere that wasn't fire prone, you might think, oh man, those Californians are crazy. Why would you live in the wildland urban interface in California when you know that fires might come for your house at any time of night? You have to keep go bag by the door. You have to evacuate at a moment's notice. This seems like no way to live. This seems to a New Yorker, at least, like no way to live. And really, it was only, I think, in 2020, when we had those really dramatic fire days in the Bay Area, when the sun didn't rise and the whole sky went orange, that most Americans really started paying attention to the effect of fire through air quality. And it's also the case that the science there is growing. This is a relatively young science. We know about air pollution. We know that 10 million people a year are dying globally from air pollution, which is a horrific number. But we know less about the effect of wildfire smoke and exactly how it differs from other kinds of air pollution. We know less about how it's dispersed over the country. You know, it used to be the case that if you were looking, even in 2020, if you were looking at the fires in California and thinking, wow, that air seems horrible, you probably thought the problem of air quality from fire was concentrated right where the fire was. But 87% of the smoke impacts of fire travel outside the county in which the fire is burning, and 60% outside the state. And in some of these recent years, we've had more health impacts in the eastern U.S. than the western U.S., even though the fires are burning in the western U.S. And that has to do with population density as well as the way that the smoke is traveling. But it does show that the impacts are not containable or quarantinable wherever the fires are. So we were sort of starting to learn that a little bit over the last couple of years, But the average person, I think, still thought of wildfire smoke as a public health threat that was concentrated where the fires themselves were burning. And the Canada fires this year really turned that on its head. Now, these fires themselves, even by the old metrics, just about area burned, are quite horrifying. Putting aside the smoke and emissions impacts, the area burned, we're talking about multiples of what the previous recent worst fires in Canadian history have been. I think it's now three times as large as the worst American fire season since 1970. So the worst season that the US has had as a country, which is a huge country, in 50 years, Canada has had like three times as much land burn this year already, and we still have months to go in fire season. So we might see maybe even twice as much area burned as we've seen to this point going forward. The production of smoke has been, you know, a real eye-opener for, especially for cities in the Midwest and the East Coast, which have really never seen this before. And in New York, where I live, you know, there were some really harrowing days. I think a lot of New Yorkers feel like this is the summer when climate impacts really hit home, even more than Hurricane Sandy, even more than Hurricane Irma. It was this these smoke events a couple of months ago that really taught us that we were vulnerable, because the lesson there is, like, you can do whatever you're going to do. You can live in your, you know, your concrete high rise. You can have your air, you know, but when you look outside and the sky is orange with smoke, and you can feel the burning embers every time you breathe outside, even if you're wearing a mask, it's just a different kind of a lesson being taught. And then we have, you know, new data the last couple of weeks. Different methodologies show different measures, but new data showing that these fires may have produced 2.5 or 3 times as much carbon as all of Canada produced last year. So you take all of their industrial activity, all of their transportation, all of their cars, all their factories, all their infrastructure, all their agriculture, all their land use changes, all of that last year as an entire country in these fires may have produced multiples of that so far this year already. So the lessons there, I think, are that this, you know, these impacts are not local. They have cascading impacts. You know, they travel around the world. They also shake out through populations. These smoke plumes have traveled all the way to Europe. And I think that's one big lesson. Another big lesson is just about the size and scale of the impacts, which is to say they are, you know, basically an unpredicted level of burning. In fact, a lot of the wildfire modeling doesn't suggest anything like this kind of area growth in Canada, even over the next few decades. So we're kind of off the charts there too, which is another reminder of how scary our uncertainty around these impacts is. And then the third thing is that we can't do anything about them. And I think this is really quite grim. I think that, you know, even those of us who are most alarmed about climate change have in the back of our minds the idea that, like, well, if the world really woke up, if the world really focused on the project of decarbonization on the one hand, but also the project of adaptation on the other, we have the resources we need to protect ourselves and secure our livelihoods for the future. So, like, building these massive flood barriers is going to be really complicated and expensive. But if we chose to do it, we could actually protect the cities where those floods were, you know, were predicted. And the fires are a different kind of a challenge. It is simply not possible to put out these fires. They are too large. There are too many of them. They're burning through mostly uninhabited land in the north of Canada. Good, smart forest management and fire policy has taught us over the last generation that we shouldn't put them out because forests need to regenerate through fire. So we don't even really want to, but even if we wanted to, we didn't have the resources or the strategy or the technical know-how to do it. And we don't have the capacity to meaningfully reduce the risk of these kinds of fires because the amount of fuel, that's what fire scientists call forest, the amount of fuel that's available in these fire-prone parts of the world is growing really dramatically. And we, you know, we can do things on the margins to limit those burn areas. But when you have a season like you're seeing this year, on some level, we're just going to have to be living with it. Like, adaptation is accommodation in this instance. It's not a new form of control. So I think those are the three big lessons from the Canadian fires. And they're quite scary. They're quite distressing. There isn't really like a happy note to pull out of it.
Well, you touched on this a little bit. But, you know, forests are typically carbon sinks. But with the increase in these extreme wildfires over the last decade, you know, how much of the recent emission reduction efforts, you know, as little as they have been by humans, how much of that has been offset by the carbon emissions from these fires?
Well, I think, you know, at a global level, carbon emissions from wildfires are not enormous. They, in a really bad year, they can be, I don't know exactly what the data is off the top of my head, something like 20% of global emissions. That's in a really bad year. In lighter years, smaller. But at a national level, it can be quite significant. You know, in California in 2020, which was their, that was their record setting year in California. They haven't had a worse year since, and they never had a year like that before. I think 6 of the 7 largest fires in modern California history burned in that one year. That's not true. It's 4 of the top 7, and then the other 2 were in 2021. In that year, more carbon was produced from the burning of California fire than had been saved in the previous 16 years of emissions reductions. So everything that California, which we think of as a green leader, everything that they had done in terms of fuel efficiency standards, in terms of, they have a carbon tax there, in terms of all those measures, in terms of their renewable rollout, all of that was over 16 years smaller than the negative impact of the fires of that season. And I mentioned earlier that in Canada this year, we're talking about the possibility that and likelihood that the fires will produce more carbon than the entire Canadian economy has produced. And that means that, like, it's not just that it's undoing a little bit of emissions reductions. It means even if we got all the way to zero, even if Canada had gotten all the way to zero and was a net zero country right now in 2023, these fires would have more than undone all of that progress. So when we're talking about countries that have reduced their emissions by, you know, 20%, 18%, depending on the country, there's a much larger margin for error, and the fires are wiping them out. And this is not the first country in the world in which this has happened. In Australia, the crazy Black Summer fires of 2019, 2020 had this effect too, that there were more carbon emissions from the fires than from all of Australia. It's possible that there have been some years in which the Siberian fires did the same in Russia, although the method, you know, the tracking is a little less good there. So, you know, it's not the case yet that at the global level, wildfire emissions are like a dominant source of carbon, but it's especially concerning because of what we were talking about earlier, that we don't really have the tools to control them. So all these other things, in theory, if we really wanted to get to net zero in 10 or 12 years, you know, we could rush through that and get at least pretty close in most of the rich countries in the world. We're not doing it at that pace, but in theory we could. But even in theory, we don't have a way to stop the fires and the carbon that they're producing. And that's really concerning, not just for hitting our targets over the next couple of decades. It's concerning in the long run, because when we're talking about our projections for the end of the century and our understanding that, you know, the planet's temperature is going to stop rising when we get to net zero, if we have any marginal emissions from fires, those could mean that we won't stop warming. And the difference between keeping carbon concentrations where they are and actually allowing the natural sinks of the planet to bring us additionally back down so that we're no longer at wherever we end up when we get to net zero, 450, 480, 500, back down to, hopefully to 350 or below. The difference between keeping the carbon concentration stable and sort of keeping the planet warming at a constant level and allowing the planet to cool down by reducing its own carbon emissions naturally, that's only a couple of gigatons a year. So the risk that wildfires could be producing that additional marginal carbon is really quite high. I think it's, in fact, I would say, given what we know now, it seems quite likely that at the end of the century, even if we totally eliminate all anthropogenic emissions entirely, we're going to be dealing with a buffer of wildfire emissions that may prevent the planet from drawing down carbon in any natural way, which means that unless we have large-scale human negative emissions, carbon concentrations will be stable, the planet will continue to warm, and we could end up in a quite scary situation where we've done all we can, and yet the problem is still getting worse.
Yeah, when I read your most recent column, the one thing that stuck out to me is what you've mentioned a couple times already, is the fact that you know, we have this kind of false belief that we can control certain aspects of nature, and that's kind of built into our climate plans. And this year is proving, you know, time and time again, that's not the case, whether it's with the wildfires or what's happening with the oceans. I mean, we're seeing off the chart ocean temperatures this year, you know, that's leading some to worry that we've reached this tipping point. We now know that several factors, such as the stronger El Nino, weaker trade winds, even an underwater volcano, have all added to the underlying effects of a warming planet. But that's really of no comfort, because humans just can't impact, they have no control over any of those natural occurrences. I mean, how concerned are you about what's happening in the oceans this year?
Well, before I get to that, let me just say briefly, it's almost more striking to me to think about, for instance, the heat extremes in a place like Phoenix, where it's a man-made city. We think this is a place where everything is controllable. We're not talking about, you know, just uninhabited forests. We're not talking about the depths of the ocean. We're talking about a city of several million people, modern city built over the last couple of decades. And in theory, we should be able to respond to those threats by changing the environment in a way that allows human life to flourish there. And I think to some degree we are. I think that, you know, deaths in Phoenix from heat would be much higher, you know, if we hadn't taken some public health measures over the last couple of decades. But it's also clear that we're not doing nearly enough. Even in a place that would be like a kind of a laboratory case study for where we should expect adaptation to reign, we're doing something, we're making a difference, we're making, you know, improving the risks on the margins, but we're not making it so that living in Phoenix when it's 120 degrees is as comfortable as living in Phoenix used to be when it was 95 degrees. We just haven't gotten there yet. So that's even, you know, in the kind of a place where you would expect us to be able to do the most. And the oceans, as you say, even more than the world's forests are just, I mean, we literally don't know what's down there. It's, you know, it's a cliche that scientists often say, you know, we understand outer space more than we understand our own oceans, but it's basically true. There are a lot of systems and dynamics which scientists have described to some extent, but don't feel entirely confident in their understanding of them. And then when those systems interact with climate impacts, very much don't understand where we are or where we're headed. And that means that's one reason why ocean scientists are really especially worried this summer, as we're seeing all of these totally off the charts sea surface temperatures, but also more localized marine heat waves. I think the latest figure I saw said that 40% of the world's oceans were experiencing heat waves, which is four times what's normal. You know, the Antarctic sea ice is so off the charts low that anytime you try to characterize it statistically and call it like a 5-standard deviation or a 6-standard deviation event, it's like, it doesn't even make sense to do that anymore because, you know, obviously the comparison is broken. If what you're saying is that we shouldn't be seeing this except once in every 7 billion years, the planet's not 7 billion years old. So, you know, we don't even have the tools with which to describe how unusual what's being seen in the oceans is. And the thing that I keep coming back to again and again when thinking about it is that, you know, we know that 90% of the excess heat from global warming is taken up by the oceans. And what that means, that stat gets cited a lot by people talking about climate, but we don't take the next step to say what that means is that the oceans are being hit 9 times as hard as we are on land. So if we think we're seeing the beginnings of a really scary climate change where we live on land, they're seeing 9 times as much impact there and have been now for decades. Now, exactly how that plays out in terms of the effects on the ocean's circulation patterns, on marine life, on, you know, the health of phytoplankton, on the health of kelp forests, all of that's up in the air. We do seem to know pretty confidently that the world's coral reefs are really imperiled by this heat, and probably in a world of 1.5 degrees, you know, the corals won't be able to recover fast enough to survive from each of these major bleaching events. All of these other impacts are, you know, again, I think worried about in uncertain terms. But in general, when it comes to climate, we've for far too long taken uncertainty as a source of comfort and say, well, we don't know that things are going to get that bad. And therefore we kind of act or at least believe or in our heart of hearts that it won't get that bad. But the events of this summer, and particularly maybe the events of the ocean, teach us that uncertainty really should be counseling us in the other direction, because we're going to be surprised on the high end quite a lot. And rather than, you know, rather than assuming that we're always going to end up on the low end of our projections, it seems the opposite is more likely to be true. And when we're talking about a system as big as the ocean, as complicated as the ocean, some of these potential tipping points are really, really quite scary and ominous. And, you know, this paper got published last week about the possibility of the collapse of the of AMOC in the North Atlantic. You know, there are a lot of questions about it. A lot of scientists don't want to take its findings to the bank. But it is a serious group of people modeling mathematically the trends in this ocean circulation pattern and saying there's a pretty good chance that this system is going to collapse in the next couple of decades. And whether it's 3 decades or 4 decades or 7 decades, as recently as the last IPCC report, they were arguing about whether it even included as a possibility of a century. So, you know, some of the headlines said it could happen as soon as 2035 or 2025, I don't even remember, right around the bend. And a lot of scientists are like, we really don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, if we're saying we need to worry about it as a risk in 2050 or 2060, as opposed to 2150 or 2160, that's a huge revision to our understanding of the near-term climate future of the planet. That's a world that I'll likely be living in. My children will certainly be living in. It's pretty much right around the corner. And again, that's happening with impact after impact, where we're saying these things that we used to think of as pretty remote possibilities now seem quite concerning. The AMOC was one of these tipping points, you know, really closely examined by the sort of tipping point scholars in their major review of 6 months or so ago. And in almost every case, they were revising the thresholds for where the tipping points would tip from where it had been a few years before when they published their previous set of work. So it's a scary time to be alive. What can I say?
Yeah. Well, The Guardian got a lot of pushback for that from scientists, as you mentioned, because they did, you know, the headline was the Gulf Stream could collapse as early as 2025. And scientists said, yeah, that's not exactly what the study said, but the study did have that range of like 2025 to 2095. As a journalist, how hard is it, or how should you communicate such uncertainty, right, in the science to the general public?
I think it's a really tricky question. I mean, I'm in a position where, you know, technically my job at the Times is I'm an opinion columnist. I can write in a more direct first person way. I can write a little bit more essayistically. The things that I can do in talking just about uncertainty as a principle are a little bit different than what's available to a news reporter who's writing in a much more circumscribed way about what a particular paper says. And the truth is, this paper does say that it is possible that this circulation system could collapse by 2025. It does say that. It's not saying that that's its median projection, but it says that it's possible. You know, in general, when you're writing those kinds of stories, I think you can solicit criticism and feedback from other scientists who have somewhat different views. And I actually think The Guardian did that in their piece. I think primarily the concern was about the headline. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about this. I've felt, maybe even especially over the course of this summer, that there's been a lot of scientific criticism of alarm and panic. We've been through this cycle before. I've been through the cycle before. But when folks on social media started worrying about the anomalous sea surface temperatures and the anomalous Antarctic sea ice, the North Atlantic heat wave, you know, in May and June, there were a lot of really pedigreed scientists who were saying, like, we shouldn't freak out. This is merely on the high end of what we would expect given the amount of global temperature rise that we've seen. And that may well be true. I defer to their expertise about all of that. But if we are seeing evidence that we are tracking on the high end of expected events at the level of warming we are today, that is concerning. The story of climate change that we're on, the curve that we're on, is scary. And I think it's perfectly legitimate and reasonable for not just lay people, but scientists too, to express concern about that and even alarm. And if somebody who's, you know, even if it's not their expertise, someone who knows a little bit about the systems of the oceans sees, you know, sea surface temperatures in a particular area, you know, 4, 5, 6 degrees above record levels. And their response to that is to go, you know, holy shit, this is scary. That's a perfectly legitimate response to have. Now, it's not necessarily the response that you'd want, you know, the headline of the New York Times or the headline of the Guardian to express. But in an article in which you're surveying scientists' feelings about the state of the ocean and where we're heading, I think it's perfectly fine to have some people in there, in fact, healthy, and to have some experts in there quoted expressing panic and uncertainty. And in fact, I think over the course of the summer, you've seen more and more of that. So in the late spring, early summer, there were a few people who were really worried, and then a lot of people saying, let's not panic just yet. And over the course of the summer, as these anomalies have not just continued but grown, we've seen a kind of growing chorus of experts saying, this is really beyond what we expected or even predicted. And we don't yet know how to understand it or make sense of it. It may just be a freak season. It may have to do with El Nino and the particular, you know, a new supercharged dynamic that we haven't seen before with El Nino. Presumably we'll be able to piece together an explanation over the course of the next few years. But again, even if you piece together an explanation, that doesn't mean that it's okay. It's like a world that's been thrown into disarray by 1.2, 1.3 degrees of warming is still a quite concerning world, even if you can say, you know, 60% of the anomaly is attributable to baseline global average temperature change and 15% to El Nino and 10% to these Saharan dust effects and this amount for the water vapor. You know, even if you can break it down, that's valuable. We want to know more about the system that we're living in. But it doesn't mean that what we're seeing is not concerning and striking. And I do think one of the jobs of climate journalism is to communicate that, especially if many people who know the material best are a little bewildered. And the way I read the science and the way that I've, you know, the conversations I've had with scientists and the comments I've read of theirs in other people's work suggest to me that there's at least a significant minority of ocean scientists who are really freaking out. And, you know, I've been down this road before and been criticized for it. But if there is a significant minority of scientists who are freaking out about something, I think one job of an honest journalistic apparatus is to communicate that to the public.
Yeah, it's super concerning. And you touched on Phoenix earlier and just how uncomfortable it is to live there, and what is a, you know, it's a rich, it's a fast growing American city. I mean, these, you know, this heat wave and so much of what we're, you know, what we've seen in 2023 in the last few years is that basically, you know, no one really is safe from these, you know, the impacts of global warming. You know, rich people, you know, they've done everything they can to avoid this as much as possible, but it's just, you know, it's changing lives. It's changing the reality in a way that there really is no kind of going back to the comforts we once knew, whether it's, you know, the fires in these popular tourist areas, just smoke, basically canceling so many of your, you know, outdoor plans in the summertime. And of course, these are, you know, these are rich people problems. So we're not asking for sympathy, but do you think people are realizing just how much of what was once enjoyed is now being, you know, basically sacrificed because the planet is just not what it used to be?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most striking, something I've observed in commentary rather than in the world of climate. But one of the most striking things I've seen over the last couple of days is a column by Neil Ferguson, who's a conservative British historian in Bloomberg. Whose last book was literally about the politics of catastrophism. And it was like a screed against the risks of catastrophism, global warming being one of the things, but not the only thing that he was writing about in that book. I think it was called The Politics of Doom. And he wrote a column in Bloomberg in which he was saying, basically, forget summer. We're not going to be taking summer vacations anymore. We're certainly not going to be taking them to the places we've been used to taking them over the course of the 20th century. And we may even come to regard this season as a kind of forbidding, scary time, as opposed to a time for delight and pleasure, because many of the places where we developed that idea about what summer was are no longer pleasurable in the summer. And he was speaking, I think, primarily about the Mediterranean. Now others have pointed out, you know, this is a, it's a bit of a blinkered view. There are plenty of other places you can go on vacation in the summer if you have the luxury of going on vacation. There are plenty of places where people vacationed in the summer already that are a lot hotter than the Mediterranean is right now. But I actually think that Europe is an interesting case study in the broader dynamic you raise, because we have had this narrative for a time. I think it's important to keep at the front of our minds that, you know, the poor world is more vulnerable for a number of reasons. The rich world is more protected, even if not perfectly protected against the impacts of climate change. But I also think that that narrative, while morally important to keep at the front of our minds, is imperfect and inadequate. And I think that heat in Europe is showing us that maybe most dramatically. So, you know, last year, last spring into the early summer, there was this unbelievable, unprecedented heat wave through South Asia, India and Pakistan in particular, where you had literally hundreds of millions of people living for, you know, days or in some cases even weeks, quite close to what had been under temperatures that had, quite close to what had been described as the maximum survivable limit for humans. And in fact, there were a couple of cities that reached that level, you know, for only for a couple of hours, but still reached this level, which had been described by scientists as a combination of heat and humidity such that even young, healthy people outside for a period of time, exerting themselves only lightly, say walking, would die. And we didn't see that mass death in South Asia. Now, almost certainly our understanding of the mortality impacts of that heat wave are inadequate. There are probably many, 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 many more heat deaths last summer in those countries than the official statistics suggest. But even so, we're not talking about the equivalent of the opening of Ministry for the Future, the Kim Stanley Robinson novel, where you have millions of people dying over the course of a couple of days. It's, if that had happened, we would have seen it very clearly. And yet in Europe, we saw temperatures that were much lower, 20, 25 degrees lower, killing, according to one recent study, 61,000 people. And that's, I think, because we've treated some of these limits as universal, when in fact they reflect cultural differences, they reflect physiological differences, they even reflect over the course of an individual's experience of an individual season, how comfortable you are in the heat. So historically, the sooner in the summer the heat wave comes, the deadlier it is, because by the end of the summer, almost everybody's kind of gotten used to the heat. And that's true at a lifelong level too. So if you're living in a place like India where you're used to seeing summer temperatures over 100, getting for a few weeks to 110 may be uncomfortable, may be hard, and maybe even will kill some people. But at the population scale, it's not going to be nearly as devastating as getting to temperatures 100, 105 in Europe. And this is really interesting for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, it gives the lie to some of the some of the morally ugly but emotionally reassuring stories we've told ourselves in the global north, that it's the it's going to be the poorer, browner people in the world who suffer most. And I don't know exactly what it tells us about adaptation and response, because while it's certainly the case that Europe is not perfectly air conditioned, there are many more Europeans who have air conditioning than people in India do. And we can do more to build out more air conditioning in Europe, although there's a carbon cost to that. We can do that in theory. But, you know, in general, we've talked about adaptation, this sort of catch-up adaptation measures like AC, as being a tool available to the poorer parts of the world, and it apparently isn't protecting even the richest parts of the world all that effectively. Now, you know, that's not to say that there's no impact. You know, as I said earlier, like if there's no air conditioning in Phoenix, we would have seen tens of thousands of deaths there this summer just in that one city. But you know, we're not to a place where we've made it comfortable to live in the new climate we're living in today. And we know it's going to get hotter. We know it's going to get messier. We know it's going to get messier, not just in the global south, but I think increasingly have an appreciation that it's going to get messier in the global north too. And, you know, the Canadian wildfire and the smoke effects of that is just another reminder, in addition to the heat waves.
Yeah, I want to switch gears here to progress, because, you know, when you first started talking on to me today, you talked about, you know, obviously things are getting worse with the planet. The impacts of global warming are starting to pop up more and more. but we are making some progress on the, you know, on the legislative level. How impactful do you think the Inflation Reduction Act will be in helping to mitigate some of the worst impacts of global warming?
Well, I guess there are a few different levels to that question. One is like, what is the role of the U.S. in general? Like, you know, if U.S. emissions go to zero, what's the effect on global average temperature and climate change? Then there's the question of what the bill is doing. And even that question is really, there's a huge range of potential impacts based on how quickly we can build out the things that have been funded in that bill or theoretically funded in that bill. And I think we haven't yet sorted that out. I mean, some of the most trusted estimates suggest that as much as 80% of the potential gains from the IRA could be lost if we don't much more rapidly build out electricity transmission and solve some permitting issues that have prevented the rapid rollout of renewables and interconnection with the grid. So I think the short answer is it's very much an open question. But I do think that, you know, in general, in part because of the IRA, but also because of changes and transformations that are larger than the IRA, I think that we are moving very much in the right direction in the US and maybe even more dramatically and significantly around the world. And we're seeing that play out already. There's genuinely a manufacturing boom in the US. It's genuinely powered mostly by clean energy production. And that's just a year since the bill was passed. With everybody complaining that the regulations aren't in place and the permitting isn't in place, we're still seeing a manufacturing boom. So I think, you know, it's certainly the case that the bill has been helpful and it's added to the momentum. Whether it achieves its full potential, I think, is an open question and a complicated one to answer and solve at the moment. But, you know, in the big picture, I may have said this to you when we last spoke, but, you know, it feels to me that we're now in a situation where if we had twice as much time, it would look really good. If we had to 2100 to get to net zero instead of 2050, I'd be really confident. You know, unfortunately, that's not the world we're living in. But it's a reminder that, you know, things are finally moving in the right direction and by historical standards, quite quickly.
Yeah, they're moving in the right direction now. And you're right, it's not fast enough. We're not doing enough to mitigate everything, but we're at least moving in the right direction.
That was part of an interview with David Wallace Wells. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP, now broadcasting on 91.9 FM. In Columbus, Ohio, I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week for another edition. Take care.